It is straight up at 8 o'clock on a Tuesday. Welcome to the Mornings with Ed show. With us this morning, we are fortunate to have Dr. Anita Wong. She has been on the front line of not just this latest pandemic. She was on the front line of the SARS virus fight back in 2009. A lot of experience in mutations, a lot of experience medically. We are delighted to have her as part of Women's History Month, where we celebrate women that have made a positive contribution to our society as a whole, and we're fortunate she's made one to our local society. We welcome this morning Dr. Anita Wong. Thank you for being here, Doctor.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you this morning. How are you this morning?
I'm great.
Good.
Every day is a great day, right? Just how you look at it.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I want to talk about you a little bit first as we celebrate Women's History Month and women that have made important contributions and continue to do so. You've done it many times in the health field. How early did you realize you were going to be drawn to medicine? When did that curiosity happen?
I think I was a slow reader. I think it was around eight years old, and we were driving back to my hometown of Carbondale, Illinois, and I was sounding out the words. I remember looking at the billboard that was in Carbondale that said, "We need doctors." And I was like, "Oh, okay, that's a good idea. I'm going to be a hometown doctor like Marcus Welby." That dates me. And then I'm going to be a surgeon. And I'm going to do surgery and take care of everybody in the town and be the family doctor. Well, that's not exactly what I ended up doing. I did emergency medicine. But in high school, I remember being in science class and I got a paper cut. Right. And I saw the finger start bleeding and I just was in awe. I said, "Oh my gosh, look at that. I disrupted the capillaries and they're bleeding. And now look at it. They're coagulating." I'm like, the body is so fascinating. And so I just fell in love with the body and the mechanism of it and how it works. And so it's just a lifelong learning because every day we learn more and more. And so it just took off from there. And, you know, at age 14, I just had to figure out a way to get to med school because I didn't think I was that bright to take the MCATs. And so I wanted to get in there somehow without having to do the hard work. And so I actually finished all my credits in high school a year early and got accepted to a medical school before I graduated from high school into a six-year medical program. Okay. And so it's just been continuous from there. It just keeps going on.
Do you find yourself learning every single day?
Oh, absolutely. I just am a lifelong learner. I get frustrated when I couldn't actually read something about medicine, because right now my focus is really anti-aging. It's always personal. I want to live as long as I can, and everything I learn about it just helps my patients since I'm in preventative medicine.
Right. Now, coming up through med school and in college, did you have women that influenced you? Did anyone take any female that was successful in medicine? Did they take you under their wing at all?
Oh, well, there was this couple, and I was kind of saddened that I didn't get, they were our mentors, our docents, as we called them. They were the Searages, and I got Mr. Dr. Searage. I didn't get Mrs. Dr. Searage, but she was this, she looked like, your grandma with the white hair and a little bun and just, you know, very loving and very knowledgeable, and, you know, so she was a good mentor and guidance, and then just, you know, the women in history, you know, Madame Curie and, Florence Nightingale, just knowing what people did for in history and medicine and advancing it and just taking the cutting edge and just being outliers sometimes. Right. I think that's important to me.
Okay.
Going against the grain.
All right. I'm in with that. And let me ask you this, this pandemic, this last 12 months that we've gone through, how will this pandemic change the way that students, for instance, in med school, the way that they learn, the way we teach kids in med school, or the way even that you practice medicine?
Well, I'm a little frustrated because in the pandemic, we are talking about, you know, the vaccine and those types of things. But we haven't really focused on therapeutics as much and what is the out, because this is majority an outpatient disease, right? Majority of people do not end up in the hospital, but those who do are critically ills and then those long haulers. But it's an outpatient, and we need studies and data and facts on how we're going to treat people in outpatient and what are we going to do. And I think what's not message is not out going out there, which I still think is very true, is the host versus the pathogen. I think how healthy our bodies are makes a big difference. So when you see somebody that has mild disease but ends up with the long haulers consequences, you have to look to see how much inflammation, what was their diet, were they eating processed foods, what was their nutritional level, what was their micronutrients, all of these factors, what is their immune response, because, you know, was their gut that healthy? So I think that that's something that I hope that nutrition, and I think that's slowly coming, integrative medicine, there are programs that are incorporating it. I mean, Cleveland Clinic has a big integrative, Georgetown University has started with functional medicine. So I think it's getting there, but then we need more of the scientific research when we're talking about these things. So no, so you're not hearing it on the nightly news saying, yes, don't eat processed foods. Keep your vitamin D up, your vitamin A, zinc, all of these things. So hopefully that is improving.
Right. And I'm going to pivot on that question right there, because this pandemic has uncovered exactly how unhealthy we are as a nation. And I've always said big gulps plus Big Macs equals big problems. So are we as a nation past the point of no return? Are we just on our way to being even more unhealthy? Are you, is that something that we're just,
no,
we're not addressing?
I think our trend is getting better though, but statistically we are only 12% healthy. That's astonishing in this country to be this great nation. And only 12% of us are deemed to be qualified as healthy because we have metabolic syndrome. So people just need to realize, and I think that we're in a bubble in California. I mean, we're a little better than across the nation, but it definitely is how we eat. And I don't think that this is too late because, you know, back in the day, because I've been in medicine over nearly 40 years, but, you know, whatever your genes were, whatever you were, that was it. You were destined to be that way. But that's not the case with epigenetics. It's so fascinating now. We can alter our DNA. We can screw our DNA up, and then we can put it back together. So by just making changes in 2 weeks, people can reverse a lot of things. And so just changing our diet and not eating processed food, eating whole foods, clean foods, you can improve a great deal. So it's not hopeless. There's light at the end of the tunnel for sure.
All right. That's important to hear. Thank you. Has anything about this coronavirus surprised you? We've been talking for the better part of a year, you and I, and you discussed it mutating 8 months ago. Has it pretty much behaved the way you expected it to, or is there anything about it that surprised you?
No, it's pretty much doing what we expect. I just hope that the variants are going to make it less virulent. Okay. We just don't know what it's doing. I mean, so, you know, there's mutations and there's so, that's commonplace. And, you know, and it mutates because it's trying to survive and, you know, we do things and it's just trying to do its thing. So whether or not it's more transmissible or whether or not it's, you know, more infectious, all of those data really need to be studied. And, the thing is, when I look at the past history, I mean, we have 4 coronaviruses that are the common cold. There's no lasting immunity. So what I anticipate is that, you know, this is not going to be a lasting immunity. We don't have, I don't think, they haven't developed a sterilizing vaccine. So what it might most likely happen is that, you know, you'll get it, get the vaccine, and then you'll have to check your antibodies. And when your antibodies wane, and, you know, and we know if it becomes a seasonal thing, then you'll know that you don't have the antibodies. You're going to want to get the vaccine, because we don't really know about this long haulers. There's so much data that we still need to learn about this. And the thing that gives me hope is, because I think it was it the Russian? Yeah, it was. I think it was the Russian flu that became that was severe. Right. And now that's one of our common colds. So we just pass it off. So I'm hoping that's what it's going to take that course.
Okay. And you brought up the vaccinations, and let's talk about the mutation of it and the virus itself looking for hosts. With only adults receiving the vaccines currently and kids returning to school soon, unvaccinated, is it logical to assume that the virus, while looking for unprotected hosts, mutates into something that targets kids? And could we be looking at a rush to vaccinate kids in the next few months?
I think that any time that we are doing it by population that are most vulnerable, right? So the children were not considered deemed as the most vulnerable because they got mild symptoms and they pass off. They are also having severe consequences. They are being hospitalized. So the percentage is a little bit lower. I haven't looked at that statistics, but you know, I think that what we're seeing is because they're getting more exposure. And so since there's more exposure, you're going to have a few that have the consequence of the virus. So, but I think, but it seems that they do respond better to the virus and fighting it off. So I think that, you know, majority of children probably have had some asymptomatic exposure,
right?
As it is, and I don't think that it's such a big deal that in schools, and as long as you're doing testing, I think that's the main thing. You're still masking. That's important, and testing, and then when you find someone that is positive, to isolate them. So we have the measures. We have the tools. We know how to mitigate. It's just whether or not we do it as in a consorted, unified system, right?
Right.
So, other countries have done it.
I had always said that kids really, we didn't get the numbers of children getting sick or infected because we kept them at home. They weren't in school, and now we're opening up schools. So I'm curious as to what that will do. To me, that's still the open question. But I'm glad you took that on with me. By the end of March, here in the next several weeks to maybe even mid-April, Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson have committed to 260 million doses of the vaccine. We'll have enough for pretty much anyone that wants it can get it at that point. What do you say to someone who refuses to get it? And should we at some point require proof of vaccinations to travel, for instance, or get on board a cruise ship or something?
Well, I don't like to straw-arm people like that. And I think that, I think one of the things that there's always a risk to everything, right? So, I mean, getting in a car and driving, there's a risk. You know, the chances of you getting in a car accident and dying is there. Getting on a plane, there's a chance of it crashing and you being having that. And the same with vaccines. But, at the way that the studies have gone and the safety and the efficacy, you know, the efficacies are higher than they've, you know, ever been for any vaccines. Vaccines are normally 50, 60% efficacy. That's our normal. So now getting it 98%, 95%, that's unheard of. So having it drop down to 70% is still higher than what we normally have. So that's not a concern for me. And the reason why it's so effective is because they were able to isolate the actual, because the coronaviruses are huge virus. And so they have all these proteins, and then your body is trying to figure out which protein is causing the disease. So it's defending against all these things. And there's only one protein producing the disease, and they were able to isolate that protein out of the spike protein and make the vaccine. And that's why it's been so highly efficacious. So, taking that, and then the safety, we've given it to millions, and we know that, you know, people who are allergic to polyethylene will actually have an anaphylactic reaction, but that's, you know, treatable and can be identified. So it's been fairly safe giving it to millions, but the long term, we don't know, because it's new. It's going to be 1 or 2 years, 3 years before we know, is there going to be any long-term effect, because it's a novel vaccine. Now, it's not going to integrate with your DNA or anything like that, because the mRNA is actually very unstable and degrades in about 3 to 4, 5 days. So it's not going to, you know, people are concerned it's going to cause infertility or integrate in your DNA. That's not happening. But we don't know the long term because it's new, right? So when I tell people, when I advise people, I say, you have to decide, are you going to get in that car and get have the risk of having a car accident, and you wanted to get to X, Y, and Z, or are you going to walk over there, right? I mean, so there's always, you have to decide. So you take the vaccine, and you don't know the long-term consequences, but we do know the consequences of the virus right now. We know that you could get ill. Right. We do know that you can have long-term sequelae, which is really devastating. Lung fibrosis, clotting disorders, strokes, heart issues. It just it goes on and on, because it affects the entire organs of the entire body system. So it's concerning, and I'm concerned about those consequences. The vaccines actually reduce the the disease and the severity, and prevents death and prevents hospitalization. So whether or not it prevents long hauler syndrome, I'm hoping it does. So you have to decide. It's like going to Las Vegas, and what is your greatest, what would you regret worse? That you didn't take the vaccine and you got long haulers, or you took the vaccine and you got this unknown consequence that we have no idea that whether or not it's going to be there or not. So those are the risks that you have to decide between. That's I see.
It seems like a really simple no-brainer.
Right.
Yeah. So, Dr. Wong, you have a practice here in town.
I do.
Okay.
I do.
And
right on Talia.
Okay, you're right. And the things that you plan to do post COVID, or even that you're doing right now, is getting this community healthy, right?
Absolutely. What I being an ER doctor, I have seen consequences of, you know, our lifestyles, and trying to educate people in the ER is just too late. You need to do it beforehand. So that's why I do this. And then also, I'm selfish because I'm you know, want to live a long time and enjoy my children because they're young. I'm an older parent, and I would love to be able to, be around for a long time. So I study all that. And so all my goals are to take all the issues that I saw in the from the emergency room that affected people, and they would complain that their golden years were not golden. You know, the joint pains, the inactivity, the weakness, the fatigue, all these things were affecting their quality of the urine, incontinence, just leaking urine, leaking feces, those are affecting their quality of life, and we want to have a good retirement and be able to enjoy life to the fullest, to the end. And so that's what I do, and I really like working. For Laguna Beach and the seniors, I actually offer a wellness assessment for them, complimentary, that like a proof of residence in Laguna Beach, so that I can get them going and thinking about that, and so that they could have a better quality of life. And the things that I do is to make sure that, you know, that they have the incontinence or they can't sleep through the night, that helps to increase their muscle core, so that their core strength is good, so that they can stand and walk, and that they have a lower fall risk, because that's always a concern. So just working on nutrition and making sure that their micronutrients are good and their mitochondria are working good, so that you have enough energy to keep going. So
how do we get in touch with you?
That's right.
How does somebody out there who's willing to take the leap, how do they get in touch with you?
Well, I offer a complimentary discovery call, and you can go to my website. It's my name, AnitaWangMD.com, and you just schedule a discovery call, and we can talk about your issues and see if I'm a good fit with you and can help you. And or you can just call me at 949-734-0580. Leave me a message. Or you can email me at info@anitawangmd.com. So, you know, I take mail too, snail mail, anyway, you know, any way you want.
Okay. Dr. Anita Wong, as part of Women's History Month, not just the work that you did with SARS back in 2009, but the work that you're doing now, getting us healthier, first of all, and working with the people in the ERs and such, your contributions cannot be overstated. So thank you for the work that you've done and the work you continue to do.
Thank you. I appreciate you and all that you do.
Dr. Anita Wong this morning on the Mornings with Ed Show. We'll talk to you again soon, Doctor.
Okay.
All right, bye. 8:21 the time. Mornings with Ed.